Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. This week, we continue with our series focused on candidates for Congress in New Hampshire's 1st and 2nd districts. Between now and the September 11th primary, you will hear from both Republican and Democratic candidates. In one-on-one interviews, each will have an opportunity to share their background, experience, and policy priorities. They will also answer questions related to the nation's fiscal challenges and how, as members of Congress, they might work to resolve them. This week, you will hear from 1st District Congressional candidates Lincoln Soldati and Eddie Edwards. But before we dive into today's discussions, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. It looks like the push for rescissions has found new life after the Senate shut down the last attempt to reduce discretionary spending authority back in June. The Trump administration is preparing a rescissions package that would cut between $2 billion and $4 billion from fiscal years 2017 and 2018 for the State Department and U.S. Agency for International Development. Senate leadership is hoping that a package containing two of the largest appropriations bills, defense and a combination of labor, HHS, and education, will be passed this month. Successful passage would mean that the Senate has approved nearly 90% of all discretionary spending for fiscal year 2019, which begins October 1st. However, a large number of amendments filed for the defense bill may prove to be significant obstacles and ruin the Senate's recent bipartisan working relationship. House Speaker Paul Ryan has indicated that a technical tax corrections package will be taken up after the November elections in an effort to fix flaws in the new tax code, such as a drafting error that would force some restaurants and retailers to deduct renovation costs over a period of as long as 39 years. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Lincoln Soldati. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Lincoln Soldati. Lincoln lives in Portsmouth with his wife. He is an Army veteran, has spent 20 years of his professional life in public office at the local and county level, including serving Summersworth on its school board, its charter commission, as mayor, and 9 terms as Stratford County attorney. Lincoln is running as a Democrat to represent the 1st Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Lincoln.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on Facing the Future. And I think before we dive into anything specifically fiscal policy oriented, I want to give you a chance to introduce yourself to our listeners, maybe explain why you're running for Congress and what some of your top policy priorities might be.
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, you know, I'm a native, a New Hampshire native. I grew up in Portsmouth and Exeter, mostly. I went to St. Thomas Aquinas High School. I went to University of Notre Dame. I was drafted in 1969. Finished up my degree at Notre Dame, and then came back to New Hampshire to go to law school. After law school, I spent a couple of years in private practice, general practice, and then was talked into running for county attorney in Stratford County, which I originally thought was going to be an opportunity to get a lot of trial experience. I love trial work. I love standing up in front of a jury. That's really what I has been my forte. And so I thought I'd do that for maybe one term, maybe two term, get the experience and go on out. But I fell in love with the job, and it really was a fabulous experience. I mean, and it's a portion of my career that I am particularly proud of, especially what we did in terms of efforts we made to protect victims of sexual assault and child abuse. And the protocols that we developed in Stratford County in the 80s and 90s is now a statewide standard. And I think that's probably the thing that I am most proud of, as well as the fact that I was the only prosecutor in New Hampshire that testified in front of the legislature for the repeal of the death penalty in New Hampshire. So it's a period of my life and my career that I am particularly proud of. I also went to Palestine, the West Bank, and mentored Palestinian public defenders. I also, in 2016, after the election, I drove out to North Dakota to Standing Rock to help the Sioux Nation fight for their water rights. And it really was there that I sort of was reintroduced to something that had been part of my life, and that's the concept of to be of use. And so when I came back from Standing Rock, I closed down my law practice after almost 40 years, became an Uber driver, which in Portsmouth I consider to be a public service.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then really I just, you know, I just kept seeing what was happening literally every day in this country, you know, and I just could not believe what was happening to the country and to our democracy. And, you know, I felt that I had dedicated a lot of my life to public service, and I was trying to figure out, you know, what is it that I can do to make a difference, because I was so, well, really horrified by what I saw happening on the national scene. And then, of course, Carol announced in October that she was not going to seek re-election, and I almost immediately felt, this is something I can do. This is a way in which I can be of use again to my community, to my state, to my country, and I felt really compelled to get in this race and fight for the issues that I think are important for our community.
And Lincoln, you displayed a lot of examples of public service, and you mentioned the phrase to be of use. It sounds like advocacy is a strong passion for you. So I'm curious, if you're elected, what are some of the top policy priorities you would pursue? What would be your primary advocacy platform?
Well, there are many policy areas where I feel very strongly. Certainly, one of my top priorities is climate change and global warming. And that is because that's an issue that is an existential issue, and it's an issue that has been broadly damaged by the current administration, and we've lost any leadership that we have in the world regarding this. And this is an issue we can't ignore. Even the Defense Department is probably one of the leaders in our government in terms of recognizing the dangers this poses and the need to take action now. This is not an issue that we can say, oh, well, you know, we can sort of wait this out. No, we actually have to do something now to address these issues. These are vital to the future, and in particular, the vital of the future of, for example, my grandchildren, which is another one of my motivations for doing this. So that's one. Another one that I have more and more become so completely engrossed in is single-payer Medicare for all. The whole healthcare situation, you know, it strikes me that we're having the wrong discussion a lot of times on this issue, because the you know, whether you're talking about the ACA or otherwise referred to as Obamacare and trying to shore that up, I mean, it had its place in history in terms of it brought millions, tens of millions of more people to be covered than were covered previously. But it didn't really solve the fundamental issue. And the fundamental problem with our healthcare system is it's based upon for-profit insurance. We don't really have a healthcare system. We have a health insurance system. And what we need is a healthcare system. We need a single-payer system in which everybody is covered from essentially, you know, prenatal to hospice care. And it should cover everything, you know, including mental health, including dental, eye care, ear loss, or hearing loss, across the board. And the amazing thing is when you actually look at the numbers, because the current system is so expensive because it relies on for-profit insurance as the basis for it, it would actually be cheaper for us to go to a single payer, essentially a universal or Medicare for all system. And the greatest beneficiaries would be businesses, which therefore translates to the fact that it would really be a positive thing for our economy as a whole. And that's what most people miss. They somehow think that this would be so expensive. The problem is, it's so expensive now. The current system is 18% of our GDP. That's $3.3 trillion, you know, which is a lot of money to some people. You know, so the idea that that a single payer system would be so expensive, it's less expensive than the system we have now.
So Lincoln, let's break that down a little bit, because I agree. 18% of our economy is committed to healthcare. $3 trillion is a lot of money to anybody. but I've seen different research on moving to a universal system and how much it will cost. Prices ranged from $15 trillion to $30 trillion. The measurable savings differs, all based on how you structure the system. So I'm curious, in moving to a Medicare for All system, from your perspective, yes, what would that system look like?
The basic premise of the program is we don't pay for insurance. We pay for care. And that's what I mean about the difference between the system we have now, which is based on insurance. It's not based on – you know, when was the last time you went to your insurance agent and said, oh, take my blood pressure, draw my blood or something? You know, that never happens, because they don't provide health care. They provide insurance. We need to get away from the concept that insurance is what we need. What we need is health care. And the system that I am really have become enamored of is one that is promoted by a group called Physicians for National Healthcare Program. This group, PNHP.org, is actually there. Actually, I have a link to it on my site. But anyway, that's their website. And this is a group that's been around for 30 years. People in the medical field that understand these issues, most of them physicians or affiliated medical personnel, who understand not only the current system, but also understand how this could be changed and be far more efficient than what we're seeing now. And that's the point. We somehow think that, oh, if we did away with the current system and went to a single-payer system, it would be so much more expensive. But that misses the point that we're all paying for this now. You know, there is no free lunch, you know, and so we pay for people who aren't covered by insurance today. We pay for it because they end up going to the emergency room and they can't pay that. 80% of personal bankruptcies in this country are due to health care. 60% of business bankruptcies are due to health care costs. So if you're benefiting businesses the most, which you would do, because instead of paying anywhere from 25 to 50% of their payroll in health care, if they're now providing health insurance, they'd pay 6%. So you go from 25 to 50% of your payroll as a business owner. You go from paying that amount of money to 6%, you're saving a tremendous amount. Now, you have a choice of what you want to do with that. You could, as one employer that I talked to after taking a tour of the plant that he runs up in North Conway, said that he'd put it in the pockets of his employees, and I thought that was great. That's one option. But he also could elect to expand his business, hire more workers. He could improve his business in other ways, or he could pocket the money. The point being, it's a tremendous amount of money that would be available to employers. And for employees, you then wouldn't have the anxiety of feeling that you have to stay in a job, perhaps that you don't enjoy, is not fulfilling, and there's something else you'd rather do. Or maybe you want to start your own business, but you can't risk a medical emergency coming up that you can't cover. So you stay in a job, what is essentially for you a dead-end job, because you can't give up your health coverage. Or you have people who have spouses or significant others that are employed, and they can't leave their job. You can't do what you want because you're so afraid of losing your health care. This gives you the freedom, because it's not tied to your employer. Employers would be freed up from having to provide health insurance for their employees.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Lincoln Soldati, and we're discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on some of the nation's fiscal challenges. Right now we're talking about health care, and I wanted to follow up on the many points you made there, Lincoln. You mentioned sort of this shift from employers carrying a lot of the cost of health care. But in my mind, that natural shift back would be to put it back on the taxpayer or the individual to carry some of the cost of the healthcare system. So just out of curiosity, when you're looking at some of these plans, Are there specific examples of what, say, the tax rate might look like or maybe the premium might look like for a Medicare for all system like you just described?
There is no premium because all that gets paid is the cost of the care. And I'll give you one example. Right now, for let's say, and there's no cost for service, no fee for service issues involved. You don't get a bill from your doctor, you don't get a bill from the hospital. It's all based upon the actual cost. One example, take an MRI. An MRI can cost you anywhere, depending upon where you go to get it, $8,000 to maybe a low of $300 somewhere. But the actual cost of doing an MRI is like $75. So, you know, why are people in this country paying $8,000, $3,000, which I think is the norm, for an MRI that costs $75,000? And it's because of for-profit hospitals, for-profit insurance companies, and also we can't forget one of the big factors in all of this is the pharmaceutical industry, you know, which is the most profitable industry in the world. The fact of the matter is we pay far too much for pharmaceuticals, unlike most other countries, including our neighbor to the north, Canada. So we either have to get back to being able to negotiate issues related to the cost of medications for people, or we just buy them from Canada and bypass the industry entirely. Of course, the problem, and one of the reasons these things don't happen, even though from an economic standpoint they make sense, they don't happen for one reason, and that is we have a corrupt system. Everything is about money. Everything is about profits. And you have insurance companies who are lining the pockets of politicians so that they won't think about even finding a solution, so that there's an incentive to simply support the current system. But we need to get away from that. Indeed, corruption and money in our politics across the board is the root of most of what is problematic in this country in terms of people not being able to get ahead.
And one last question on healthcare, Lincoln. Sure. We spent the entire interview on it so far. It's a big topic. It's an important one.
It is.
Medicare, right now, its trustees have indicated that its trust fund is on its way to insolvency by 2026. Perhaps reform is necessary in the system right now, even before we transition to something larger like a Medicare for All system, which I also think would take a pretty big shift in how we think about healthcare as a country in general. So would you make any reforms to Medicare in the interim, say, as you're representing New Hampshire and working toward that Medicare for All system?
Well, I think that if the goal eventually is to go to a single-payer, essentially Medicare for All system, and in many ways the use of the term Medicare is more symbolic because it's a system we know that actually is run incredibly efficiently, surprisingly, by many people's estimate. We're talking about radical change even to Medicare. So one of the things that's important to recognize is we're not going to pass a bill in Congress and then the next day after it's signed into law, we suddenly have this whole new system. This is a large system, and it needs to be understood that this is the goal that we are aiming towards, and there will be a need to transition into that. And whether it's transitioning from something like the ACA or expanding Medicare for us as an initial step, you know, there's many ways to look at that. But this is going to be something that'll take many years, perhaps a decade or longer to actually accomplish. So there are many phases that we're going to see parts of our system transition into this because, you know, these are huge institutions. They're ingrained. And, you know, we do not want to shock the system. We want to improve the system. So we do have to recognize that there's a transition period that will occur.
And you hit the nail on the head with it being a huge system. And Medicare is a mandatory spending program built into the federal budget as a result of law and formulas. Another program similar to that is Social Security. And the trustees for that program have also indicated that it's running towards insolvency by 2034. And if we do nothing to the program, you could see about a 24% benefit cut to current beneficiaries, which I don't think anybody would really want to see happen. So from your perspective, are there reforms that are necessary for Social Security now, whether it's sustaining it for the long term or changing it for future generations?
Social Security is actually the easiest one to deal with because all we have to do is lift the cap. I've never heard a rational explanation as to why we have a cap on Social Security, which I think is, I may be off a few thousand here, but it's either $124,000 or $127,000.
I think it's about $127,000 right now.
$127,000 yeah. Now. Okay. But nobody's explained to me why we have a cap on that. And if you simply remove the cap, the system is solvent. As solvent as the eye can see, as far as the eye can see. That's an easy one, it seems to me. I don't see any rationale for the cap to begin with. I've never heard an explanation for the cap. And it's quite easy to do. The one thing I would say about whether we're talking about Medicare, we're talking about Social Security, the one thing that, particularly as a senior who is both on Social Security, by the way, and a Medicare recipient.
So should I say you're welcome?
No, because here's the thing. Don't tell me it's an entitlement. And I will tell you why, okay? I've worked 55 years of my life, and every single paycheck I ever earned, I paid for Medicare. Well, starting in 65, I paid for Medicare. I'm a little too old for that, right? Anyway, I paid for Medicare and I paid for Social Security every single paycheck. And that was whether I was working for somebody else in a private company, or whether when I worked for the county, or when I had my own business and was self-employed. Every single paycheck, a portion of mine went to pay for Medicare and went to pay for Social Security. So I have paid for that. That's an earned benefit. It's not some gift that you're giving me. So I've earned it. Everybody in this country who works has earned those benefits.
And I think I do want to clarify, Lincoln, the phrase entitlement is really just a budgetary reference, just like saying mandatory spending, because of how it's structured. And the fact remains that current generations of workers pay for current generations of retirees. But you're right, earned benefit in the sense that you paid into it your whole life. I'm doing the same thing right now. So I don't want to get in a squabble over that, but I did want to clarify.
Well, but the term entitlement has become a pejorative, which is why I don't like the term. It's important for us to restate what is actually occurring and what it is. These are earned benefits that workers pay their entire lives on.
So I think we're running short on time, but there's one issue I want to get back to real quick. And you brought up climate change earlier in the show. A lot of efforts on that fall into the category of discretionary spending, which is what's part of the appropriations process. We're running almost $1 trillion deficits already. If you are in Congress and you're working on issues to address climate change, how do you pay for them in this current fiscal environment?
Well, first of all, you have to realize investment in renewables, for example, is just that. It's an investment. It's not really a payment of an expense that's gone, because that's investing in the future. Because if we don't address these issues, the cost to us in the future are almost incalculable. Some people actually argue, I had a conversation the other day with a PhD in meteorologist who said, as far as he's concerned, we've already passed the tipping point. I'm hoping that's not true, because if that's the case, then it's a fairly bleak future. But we could also impose, for example, a carbon tax. We could invest in renewables. We could cut the subsidies to the fossil fuel industries, and we could stop offshore drilling. So there's a lot of measures we could take that will boost our use of renewables and reliance on renewables and an investment in renewables that really will prepare us well for the future to decrease the amount of carbon that's entering the atmosphere.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Lincoln Soldati discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Lincoln.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Up next, I'll be joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Eddie Edwards. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by New Hampshire congressional candidate Eddie Edwards. Eddie lives in Dover with his wife. He's a Navy veteran, was chief of the New Hampshire State Division of Liquor Enforcement for 8 years, and he was chief of the Southampton Police Department. After a career in law enforcement, he moved into the private sector and launched a business working with other small businesses. He's a board member of the Partnership for a Drug-Free New Hampshire and chairs the Governor's Advisory Group on Juvenile Justice. Eddie is running as a Republican to represent the 1st Congressional District of New Hampshire. Thank you for joining the show, Eddie.
Thank you for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on.
It's a pleasure to have you on Facing the Future, Eddie. And before we jump into any fiscal policy specific questions, it'd be great for you to introduce yourself to our listeners, explain why you're running to represent the 1st Congressional District, and what some of your top policy priorities might be.
Sure. Thank you for the opportunity. I love the title of the show, Facing the Future. And it's one of the things I really believe strongly in is our future. And, you know, as a kid growing up in a very challenging home, facing domestic violence, watching my mother being beaten by my father, and growing up in a drug-infested home neighborhood, you walk away with a different set of responsibilities. And I was blessed in life that I had a grandmother who kind of stepped in and taught me American values, taught me how to, you know, love, forgive, pray, how to be self-reliant and independent. So I've forgiven my father for a lot of stuff a long time ago, and I learned solid American values. And as I grew, I started to realize that many of the things that faces communities of challenges, challenges to the communities, and really starts to cripple families is the expansive role of government that plays in our lives on a daily basis. And having been someone who served in government, served our country as a United States veteran and as a police officer, I really understand that the best way to resolve most of our issues is have families and communities empowered. And that only takes place when we remove the heavy hand of the influence of government. But those are the things that I'm really running for is our families, the future of our country, the culture, the things that I grew up with, the values that made us a great nation. And I think that's important to get back to. And so the things I believe in mostly, and what I really want to address, and these aren't challenging things, but I really believe that they're the things that restore power back to the people in this country. And that is addressing the administrative state of government, our debt, making sure that government does not play a vital role in our lives, but government plays a role that it was designed to play, particularly at the federal level, and that's a limited role. And government's best when it's closest to the people where they can control it. And also looking at the power and abuse that stays in those elected officials. That's why I'm a strong believer in term limits and removing the benefits that are there for elected officials. And people always ask, well, how can you get those things done? Well, certainly anyone who's elected in 2018 and moving forward, those are things that we can easily change. You're going to have a difficult time getting people to go along with things that they've already benefited from. But moving forward, I think those are things we can change.
And Eddie, you mentioned one buzzword, the nation's debt. We're at about a $21 trillion total debt. We've got growing budget deficits on an annual basis. Can you give me a brief maybe snapshot of how you might rein in some of our spending or increase revenue or some balance of the two?
Well, when it comes to debt, I feel as though our founders felt, and certainly something my grandmother believed in, she never owned a credit card. And I think we become a nation where we allow individual folks to make acquire a lot of debt in their life, and so we've created a culture of debt. And so our government operates off that. I think we must be one of the few nations where you actually borrow money to give to people who don't really like you. So I just think it's a bad way to govern, number one. Also, I think, as our founders believed as well, it's one of the worst things that a culture can do is pass on debt to their children and grandchildren. In our case, we're passing on debt to our great-grandchildren. And this is because, in my estimation, everyone wants something from government now. Everyone. It was a time when people were not interested in taking handouts or taking subsidies or any form of welfare. But now it's become commonplace. So everyone wants their subsidy. They just want you to take away the subsidy for someone else. Everyone wants to see government limited and cut, but not the government that provides something for them. So I think until we get to a place in our where we change the fundamental values of our country, we're going to have a hard time addressing debt. Debt, at one point in our nation, was something that was frowned upon. Debt now is something that people fully embrace. That's what I mean by changing our culture. We've changed our culture so much that it's hard for people to understand why you would want to eliminate or cut a program. And we build upon programs. We really have to get to a place where people are going to have to make some tough decisions. Tough decisions, I'm sure you've been around a while, so you've heard that. You've heard that from many people who ran from all levels of government saying the same things. And this is why I go back to what I've said at the beginning here. It's a cultural issue. Debt is a reflection of our culture now. And we have to get back to a place where people want to spend what they can afford. And just raising revenues doesn't address the problem of spending. Spending is a tax. And so people really understand how that works. We're going to have a tough time getting our budget and getting our affairs in order.
So, Eddie, let's stay on this big picture issue here, the idea of making tough decisions. When you look at the structure of the budget right now, we've got mandatory spending, which is written into law. It's almost on autopilot. Programs like Social Security and Medicare, and they're largely driven by demographics because of what we're seeing in our nation in the retirement of the baby boom generation. So what are some of the tough decisions you think are necessary to address either the growth of spending, the lack of revenue, bridging that gap? And it sounds like you want to alter, in a sense, how the nation views the role of government. So where do you start? That's a big task.
Well, it's an enormous task. And what happens is that because we're only focused on a limited snapshot in time, right? So I'm running to be a U.S. representative, and that's a two-year term. Think, okay, what's the big picture? How do we change this? How do we change a culture that we developed over the last 60 years to how we got here? So how do we change that? Well, we have to go back and educate people. We're not really educating our students at an early level in life to understand economics. So we're not talking about those type of things. We're not talking about the education I received just at home from my grandmother, for instance, about how to be self-reliant and independent. If you want something, you have to go out and earn it. You don't pay for things on credit. And so when you change that, you begin to change how people view their own life, their own spending, and what they're expecting, what they are willing to tolerate from government. Right now, that requires a change. So when you talk about cutting, you can't have that discussion without thinking about the people who you're talking about. Right now, if we develop a culture of dependency, very hard to have a conversation with folks who are dependent and have an expectation that government is going to provide. And that's just not our families anymore. That's businesses. That's everyone. So everyone has to look at this in the standpoint to say, okay, what are we willing to tolerate to get this out of order, bring this back under control? But you have to do both. We have to learn how to chew bubblegum and walk at the same time. And part of that is we have to go back upstream and educate our young folks as they enter the workforce, as they enter these places where they will have say and their expectations for that. But also we have to look at the promises that government has made. And government should never make promises, because when government guarantees things, then that's an expectation. People live their life. They begin to develop around that. And government begins to take money in and transfer it and put it into programs that you may or may not support. So we have a whole lot of things we have to correct. But it really starts with the foundational structure of your families. Because if you have strong families, you'll have responsible families. Responsible families will produce responsible people. Responsible people will make sure we have a responsible, strong nation. And this is it's a long journey back home to get to a sensible, responsible place. It doesn't start just because we're talking about cuts. And the reason you haven't seen a lot of changes in these areas, because right now it's just a dance. People come to politics and they say there's talking points that you're given. There's things that you talk about that make sense to people, and it's music to their ears. They like to hear those things, but nothing is ever resolved or ever changed, because you can't change these things without changing your culture.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with New Hampshire congressional candidate Eddie Edwards, and we're discussing his policy priorities as well as his take on some of the nation's fiscal challenges. And Eddie, I wanted to follow up on a phrase that you mentioned, and that was you can't talk about cutting without talking about the people that are relying upon those programs. So it might be a great opportunity to sort of drill down into some of these programs we've already been discussing. So let's start with Medicare and Social Security, two very big programs, very much a part of the culture of our nation. Millions of people rely upon them. So in terms of making changes there, because their trustees have indicated for the last several years that both programs are marching towards insolvency pretty rapidly, from your view, is reform effective? Current retirees, those about to retire, are you altering benefits, or are you looking at making these programs sustainable long term, but perhaps they look different for future generations?
Absolutely. I mean, you have to sustain what you have promised to people. People are paid into those programs, right? So those are promises, but they have also participated in paying into those programs. It's really unfair to look back and try to alter something you've made commitments to and people are paid into. Now, moving forward, we have to be able to swallow the big pill here and make sure that we change the system for future generations, though, because we can't sustain that system. And you don't just keep a system in place when you know it's not going to work. So we have to promises made, promises kept, we have to do that. But moving forward, we certainly have to look into a different way of making sure that people have retirements and they're responsible for their own retirements. You know, as you know, Social Security started off as that insurance. It was an insurance plan, but it was never designed to be what it has become and what people have come to know it as. So we can't put our seniors in a vulnerable position. We can't put those folks who are near retirement in a vulnerable position. But that doesn't mean that future generations of workforces, folks who haven't even began working yet, we can't put things in place that make their future more secure either. So those are the things we have to do.
Eddie, just another quick follow-up there since we're talking about Social Security. Do you have any specific policy changes or reforms that you might pursue as a member of Congress to help make it sustainable for current generations when we're in a sense faced with a deadline? By 2034, we'd see about a 24% benefit cut if we don't make any changes. Out the gate, what are some of the short-term changes you might make?
Well, out the gate, I think you have to have every option on the table. You have to. And I hate being disingenuous or just using you know, standard talking points, but it's impossible for me to know what all the options will be before us without being there to actually look at it, right? So, I mean, all of us are making comments or suggestions about things that was not really, we don't have all the data sets on and all the points. But I think every single thing must be on the table as part of that conversation. It has to be. The moment you start taking things off the table, you're really limiting yourself to be effective at making the change necessary.
We're down to about a third of the $4 trillion mm-hmm. national budget as committed to discretionary spending. About half is national defense. About half is all other domestic investment. Are there any particular spending priorities you would have on the discretionary side that you would be working toward or championing? And if so, how do you pay for them?
Well, some of those things, you know, I probably take a more unique look at this in terms of when it comes to our national defense spending and what we're doing in other parts of the world. You know, as you know, we represent 6% of the world's population, America. And that means that 94% of the world is dependent upon us to provide some level of security and protection for everyone else. And that's a cost. That's an economic cost as well as a human cost that we pay. I think we really have to look at some of our allies around the world and ask for them to pay. You know, when you look, and we have nearly 800 military installations around the globe in nearly 70 countries at a tune, last I saw, was close to $150 billion a year. Well, you know, I think it's time for some of those countries to start paying us for those type of services. Now, some of that's in our interest, but some of it's not. And I think you have to have people willing to pay their cost for American services. And because we can't sustain, you know, direct foreign aid to folks and also paying for their protection at the same time. Those are the type of things that begin to hurt us here at home as well. And long term, we need to make some hard decisions, both in our mandatory spending and our discretionary spending. And it starts with looking at what our responsibility really is in the world and what is our responsibility here at home and where can we make significant changes here at home and abroad to bring some of that discretionary spending back into line.
Speaking of responsibilities here at home, are there any domestic areas of investment that you think are necessary? I know in Congress they've been talking about an infrastructure investment plan for the last year or so, but haven't figured out a way to structure it best or pay for it. What would be your approach on, say, infrastructure or education or different aspects of domestic spending?
I think you start to look at where we're spending money, right? So if we're spending money, as I said earlier in the program, you know, we're borrowing money to give to other nations. So that money is used to build their schools, their roads, their bridges. I mean, just think about that for a moment. We borrow money to give to another country to build their roads, schools, and bridges. Why wouldn't we pull back those resources until we've invested back in our own country? You know, we can't loan what we don't have. We can't spend what we don't have. So I just think it's irresponsible to keep going down the same road. So I think you have to rein that back in and say to the world, sorry, we can't loan you the money that we used to. We can't give you the money we used to because our roads and bridges are falling apart here at home. So you have to do those things. And as far as education goes, that's the key here, at least in my estimation, that knowledge is very, very important. And if you, you know, I recently said to a young high school student that your parents are the most important people into the development of your education. Those are your parents. And then next year's principal, your school teacher, the local school board, than perhaps a state school board. Not sure why we have a federal Department of Education when we have four or five letters already invested in education. This is what I mean. The way you begin to think is how you'll act, how you'll perform. And I just think that we've gotten to a place where we believe that government is able to do all sorts of things. And government doesn't do anything. People do things. So it's the attitude and the responsibility of people. And I think until you get back to a place where you expect families and communities and perhaps religious organizations to be more involved into the development of individuals and communities, we're going to continue to spend and rely on big government. And as long as we have that type of cultural expectation, it's going to be very hard to rein in government and rein in spending, because everyone now has their hand in the cookie jar. Very few people are interested in who manufactures or build a cookie jar or put the cookies in the jar. So I think we have to get back to a place where we have a responsible-led citizens and limit their expectation of government involvement.
Andy, we've been talking a lot about the spending side of the budget. It's probably about time we talk a little bit about revenue. We recently went through a bout of tax reform, and most economists who looked at that tax bill and the changes in the code have indicated that it'll add about $1 trillion to the national debt over the next 10 years, and that's in addition to the structural deficits we're already seeing, which are adding about $10 trillion over the next 10 years. So what's your perspective on the last round of tax reform, maybe future tax reform, and how we find a way to bridge that deficit gap? Because, as we've been discussing, in the short term, we've got some very big spending programs that aren't necessarily shrinking in size in the near term.
It goes back to our earlier conversation. That's why I'm glad we spent time there working on the spending side, because that's really where this problem comes in. Government suggesting that they're going to give you more of your money back has become a problem. I mean, the very notion that someone thinks if you are able to retain more of your money, that's a bad thing. That's not a bad thing. That's a very good thing. It forces you to come up with creative ways to address what you think government should be providing. Now, some of the services that are in government should be back into the private sector, right? So I think the more that we can figure out ways to get more money back into people's hands and their businesses, because the business, if you're a business person, it makes no difference to you if you're paying the tax or if you're going to hire someone. But it does make a difference in our community, because the business person, if he pays the tax to government to provide some service, or if that money is being used to hire someone else, or train someone else, or increase the wages of someone else, that, to me, is more beneficial to the community than the government having the money to come up with a program to only to send it back down to the state or to the local communities. So I think you really have to look at how much money are we willing to have government manage versus families and businesses have in their pocket. And this notion that we must continue to figure out ways to drive revenue back to the government so that they can operate. Well, some of these things we have to look at, are they really necessary? This notion that you can't provide tax cuts or give money back to businesses and citizens because it's irresponsible, because you're going to hurt, are you going to create more debt? The debt's only created because we haven't controlled the spending. I mean, that's really becomes the problem. Politicians use this as talking points in the game and the dance, but this really has to do with the, as has been saying all along, at least from my estimation, this has to do with cultural expectations. And if you build up a culture that believes that you are not entitled to your money, you have to pay the lion's share of that or a great portion of that to the government, so the government can operate and provide programs that you may or may not agree with, I think is wrong. And I think if we could figure out a way to put more money in the family's hands and back into business people's hands, greater things will happen. Now, you're seeing that take place right now. We have record low unemployment. Wages are starting to increase. But government is so massive and so big that we have to figure out ways to fund it. I'm saying just the opposite. Let's make sure that the communities have those resources in place. Let's make sure that we eliminate regulations. Let's remove those barriers and get back to a place where we are really pro-enterprise in this nation.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me and New Hampshire congressional candidate Eddie Edwards discuss his policy priorities and approach to tackling our nation's fiscal policy challenges. Thank you for joining the show, Eddie.
Thank you so much for having me, and I look forward to receive report on September 11th. Don't forget to vote.
Next week, you will hear from more congressional candidates. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.